Welcome to Spirit in Action. My name is Mark Helpsmeet, and each week we bring you visits and conversations with people doing healing work for this world, hearing what they're doing and what inspires them and supports them in doing it. Welcome to Spirit in Action. I have a brand new friend. Giselle Bolton is an inspiration of where a passionate heart for healing the world can lead you. From her home in the Chippewa Valley of Wisconsin, Giselle earned degrees in international politics and human rights, and in global studies, human rights, and justice in the Middle East and Africa. She added languages, including Arabic, to her toolkit, and she volunteered and interned in diverse countries like Lebanon, Kenya, and Honduras. Giselle worked with the Nonviolent Peace Force, both domestically and abroad, and has worked helping refugees, displaced persons, and many other folks in places like Syria, Bangladesh, Sudan, and most recently in Gaza, Palestine, in the midst of the war there. She contacted me about her monthly peace stand here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, after just 3 weeks back from Gaza. So I invited her over for my special pancakes and home-harvested maple syrup and for an interview. Giselle Bolton joins me in person today. Giselle, it's great to have you here today for Spirit in Action.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
How were the pancakes?
Awesome. So good. Best pancakes I've ever had.
With both the spices, the acorn flour.
And everything. Everything. I'm so full in the best way. It was really good. Thank you.
You've only been back very shortly, a few weeks now, from Gaza. And, you know, before that, in Bangladesh. How is it for you being in the U.S. right now after having had that intensity and alternate experience? How are you feeling?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's a tough one to answer, to be completely honest. It changes a lot throughout the day. Sometimes it feels super good and really normal to be home. And then other times really disconnected and really emotional. You kind of feel like, where was I? Was that real? Like you're just in this completely different place. So yeah, a bit all over the place, to be completely honest. Yeah. So just, you know, going through it, all the emotions every day right now.
Why did you come back to Chippewa Falls or Eau Claire at this point?
For my dog. So I'm originally from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. My dog was here and my family. So just home for the moment, probably a little bit shorter than I thought, to just take a little bit of a breather. So here I am.
Talk a little bit about what a breather means. Again, you were over in the area of Egypt, Jordan, Gaza. You were doing an assessment for projects that are needed there.
Yes.
Did you finish doing that assessment and come back? Or was it more of an emergency thing? When I was in the Peace Corps, not rarely, people would be medically evacuated because of various things. And it could be mental, or it could be a disease, or it could be they broke a leg, or who knows what. What's breather mean to you?
So I was meant to be on a short-term, 2-month, 8-week emergency response in Gaza to assess basically what it's going to take to make critical, you know, life-saving projects doable, operational. So we went in for 2.5 weeks, basically to understand the situation and see what it would be to kind of have a base operating to run humanitarian activities. Unfortunately, it was cut short due to it's just not possible. We left early because of the security situation, and no one has been back in since that I'm aware of from the group that I went in to do the assessment with, because you're just a bit paralyzed. I mean, nothing is operational right now. So I was only on the mission, I think, maybe 5 weeks, which we originally planned for 8. And that was purely because running humanitarian activities right now for Gaza is basically impossible at this stage.
From multiple points of view, I'm assuming, because I'm thinking that not only are you aware that a bomb could drop on your head any moment, but you don't have electricity, you don't have medical facilities, the roads are probably not operational. I assume it was a confluence of all those problems.
Yeah, absolutely. you know, usually when you're running a humanitarian operation, you have a base, you have somewhere that you can live and work out of. It very basic, but you know, you have a roof and a floor and, you know, running water, electricity sometimes, you know, the basics to be able to have a team of people come in and run an operation. That is just not possible right now in Gaza. The operation that I was on, we were staying with 40 other displaced individuals from northern Gaza. So it's, you know, almost 45 people in a two-bedroom house. It was purely not possible. You know, you can't even bring in an emergency team right now because there's nowhere for anyone to stay because everyone is displaced. So there's just the pure logistical part there of just getting a base. There's nowhere to even have people stay or work from. There's no space. And then you have, obviously, the security issues. You know, while I was there, you can hear drones constantly. You can hear and see airstrikes constantly going on in the north. And you could feel the situation becoming more intense by the hour. You could see people coming in from the north, you know, on carts with donkeys because there's no gas. So even if people had cars to bring all of their belongings, they're out of fuel by now, for sure. And you have that issue also as well with bringing in a team of people. There's no food, there's no water, there's no gas. So having people there to work is logistically, it's just not feasible. Also, the kind of projects and things that we want to be doing, the capacity and way to operate is just not there right now because it's the situation is changing not even by the hour. I mean, we're talking 10 minutes. We thought we were going to be able to run this really critical water trucking activity in this, you know, newly popped up camp, you know, so that water trucking, critical service, people need water, they're in tents, you know, we need to be able to do that. Well, now it's somehow not secure and the company that we were working with for the trucks, there's no fuel anymore. So we're done doing that. We can't do that. The situation changes so quickly and the resources are just not there. And then obviously the security situation.
I was wondering, in the breather that you said you needed, that I figured Giselle's been there, bombs, the people you're hanging out with, all the 40 displaced people, fear must be so palpable. I can't imagine my adrenals could survive that kind of thing long term. It's not just for the displaced people, but for you.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy what your mind will do to protect itself and let you be there to function and be able to do this kind of work. So I think you just kind of go into separation mode. Okay, I came here to do this and try to focus on that and do it. But it was really intense. And obviously, it's a lot, you know, I've been going into different emergencies in various contexts for a better part of 5 or 6 years now. This one was really different living with individuals who've just lost everything. They're showing us pictures of their homes that have been completely destroyed, family members that they can't find or get a hold of and haven't for months. So that was a really different dynamic as well, because you're right there next to each other. And then also be trying to be like, okay, so guys, what do we need to do to get these projects moving? Here's what the donor has given us, and here's what we need to do by this date. Here's what the reporting is going to look like. It's a whole, you know, trying to navigate these two very different dynamics. It's really crazy. And yeah, probably really exhausting for the mind, probably more than I really realized. So, you know, I'm still fresh home. I'm sure that's why also my emotions are a bit all over the place, you know, the roller coaster throughout the day. Just kind of coming down from that, yeah, heaviness and trying to navigate all these different emotions, but also keeping a face for the people that you're there to help.
This is maybe a bit presumptuous as a question, so please forgive me if I'm being unfair. I feel right now like I want to be holding you while you're crying because I feel the tears within me. There's this mixed feeling I imagine that you have. Coming back, it's like a relief. I'm safe. I'm not going to have a bomb drop to me any moment. Oh, no, those people I was just living with, they're still sitting there under the bombs.
Yeah.
Is that your situation or not?
Yeah, absolutely. And trying to make sense of both. I mean, that's why basic, you know, like I said, it kind of feels like, you know, when I'm able to go to my yoga class and run to the grocery store, but I was just in Gaza a few weeks ago and you can't really make sense of, I can't yet because it's so extreme. So yeah, it's really hard. I'm sure that there's, you know, processing, you know, as we go and discuss, but yeah, trying to make sense of both. And I can say leaving Gaza, I mean, I was so happy to be leaving. I mean, for myself, because it was so heavy and the environment is so intense. I mean, nonstop drones. I mean, there's a whole psychological part of it as well that you don't really recognize until you do exit and you're like, oh my gosh, that was a lot. And then you have this really heavy guilt, like, well, I just get to coordinate a convoy tomorrow to make sure that I can leave and get to the border of Egypt. But these guys that I'm sleeping next to, you know, and they very generously, you know, let me sleep right next to them, showed me pictures of their homes, shared their stories with me, shared their food with me. I mean, everything. And here I am being like, I'm ready to go. You know, I mean, it's the guilt is definitely there. And I will say, obviously, as well, I've never seen something like I did leaving. You know, I've gone, you know, in various contexts and missions, but leaving and crossing out after you've just seen the worst of the worst of human suffering and the need, and then you're crossing out at the border and you see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds for miles, trucks full of food, medical supplies, tents, critical items stalled at the border. And then, you know, you're trying to make sense of that. Like, a mile behind me, I know people. Can I have some of that? I can bring it to them really quick, you know? So trying to also make sense of that is really hard. A lot of, yeah, maybe some kind of guilt, I guess, there.
Your work for these past 5, 6, 7 years has been largely with camp coordination, camp management. The CCCM has a real nice sound for bureaucracy. I don't know how that connects to real people and the real suffering, the real deprivation, the real fear that you're sitting in the midst of. Do they train you when you were doing your master's, your global studies, your international politics, human rights master's? Do they train you to disengage your feelings so you can watch, observe, manage in that situation where the fear and the anger and all that would otherwise close you down completely?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of how or if it's talked about a lot, what kind of mental and emotional situation you're signing up for in a humanitarian aid career. I'm not really sure that you have any kind of preparation or training for that during school, because I don't think it's anything they can tell you in a classroom. Or if they did, it was purely that. It was sitting behind a computer in front of a lecture, you know, maybe saying, hey, you know, it's really challenging for these reasons. But I don't think anything can prepare you for it until you're doing it. I do think, that being said, I mean, for example, during my undergrad, there were so many opportunities to go abroad and do really short term, you know, some kind of short term missions, whether it be with education or water assessments, things like that, that you can kind of do for a semester or even for the summer. And I think that's a really good, more hands on way to see, like, okay, here's a little taste of what it might look like in this career and what this might look like, what it would be, and how would I be able to take care of myself in that kind of setting, maybe long term, if this is really a career that I want to go into. So I think maybe not in a classroom or anything like that, but definitely those opportunities to get that hands-on short-term experience is definitely there and critical. Critical.
Did you do that actually while you were in school?
I did, yeah. So every summer, like when I was in my undergrad, I did short-term missions. So I went to Honduras, I went to Kenya. Yeah. So just to kind of get that experience with these more short-term, like, okay, this is kind of what I'm thinking about going into. Do I have, you know, being away from family, being away from the comforts of whatever it may be for me, not in Minneapolis or, you know, Chippewa Falls anymore. Is that something that I can mentally and physically do? So yeah, I would do those. And then I also studied abroad during my undergrad as well in Jordan. So also, you know, different opportunities of being in an international setting and away from home and kind of in tougher places and kind of try to see, okay, is this something I still want to pursue?
Were you ever drawn to do a semester in Paris or London? Because you actually did your master's in,
yes,
London.
Yeah.
So was that attractive to you? Was that enjoyable? Was that like, wait, I should get to the real stuff?
Yeah, that's kind of what it always feels like, because I keep doing this to myself the last couple of years. Like, okay, soon I'll do an HQ, you know, somewhere. Go to DC or New York or London. But I don't know, I would feel so removed from it, I think. So I'm still really liking being hands-on in the field, in it. But I see why eventually people go to different spots. So, yeah.
Folks, we're speaking today for Spirit in Action with Giselle Bolton. And Giselle is pronounced properly the way I'm doing it, not the way probably most Americans do it. How do other people say it to you?
Giselle sometimes, Giesley. Yeah, I've heard it all. I've heard it all. So yes, I appreciate a nice French pronunciation.
Was your mother a French speaker? Where did Giselle come from?
They just liked the name. They just liked the name, yeah.
So Giselle is here with me in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, good French name city, Eau Claire.
Yes.
We got in contact with one another because she was checking being a part of the monthly peace stand that we have here, wondering if she'd be welcome for that, which of course she is. So she contacted me, seeing my name on a resource there. I invited her over for pancake breakfast, and we're just talking following that. So I'm just getting to know you, Giselle, and I think I want you to be my best friend.
Oh, that's really sweet.
Although it's going to be kind of hard with you off there. I understand this past week you got contacted again about possibly going back. What was that about?
Yeah, nothing set yet. But I mean, since I even left, I was like, before I left Gaza, I was like, oh, I'm sure I'll be back. So yeah, having some discussions this week with a previous organization that I've worked for to see if there'll be some opportunities to go back. Let's see if the context and situation changes at all for the better, and maybe we're able to get humanitarian workers in there easier. We're able to get resources and items and the things that we need to run critical life-saving activities. So I'm really optimistic that maybe the situation will change and I can go back and do a little bit more.
And which organization were you working with and they're talking to you now?
I acted. It's a large French INGO. So I worked with them in previous places, Iraq, Syria, most recently in Bangladesh. And then in Gaza, I was with another French INGO, PUI.
PUI. So you only know the letters, but...
Yeah, because I don't speak French. So I'll let you let you look those up and pronounce them correctly.
Can you say it in Arabic, maybe?
Oh, no. Oh, gosh, no.
I'm assuming you're using English when you're deployed in most of these places. Is
yes.
that true? But you know, when you were working in Iraq or when you were working in Sudan, is it all English?
It really depends. For example, when I was a camp manager in northeast Syria, so I was managing one of the largest IDP camps there, I had a translator with me all the time.
An IDP, internally displaced person?
Yes. I'm trying really hard to not put out a lot of acronyms, actually. So, yeah, IDP camp.
What I really would like to do, though, Giselle, is to revisit your past. The thing that got you to actually looking forward to, being motivated to going to Palestine right now, I'm imagining that a good percentage of our listeners, as much as they may be very concerned about what's happening there, mm-hmm. the idea of going scares the crap out of them. And it's like, no, I just want to hire, I want to vote so that someone does something good about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not an unreasonable thing. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, you don't seem to have this aversion of going into the pits of hell.
You know, I think having pretty significant experience in more volatile, unpredictable, high security situations, I have a pretty good idea of how these environments can work. And I know that somebody has to go and do it.
And it's going to be you. Let's revisit what got you to this place where you're both motivated and equipped to do this kind of work. You grew up in, you know, halfway up Wisconsin on the west side, Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, very close to one another. Chippewa Falls is, I don't know, several thousand people. It's not a big city. Did you know about the world outside of Chippewa Falls growing up?
Yeah, so I traveled a little bit when I was younger. So I traveled, I had family in Germany, so I think I was in elementary school when I went to Europe for the first time. So I think I got a little taste for it then. And then just always, I don't know, kind of, it must have just stuck with me, you know, having that little taste and idea of like, wow, that was really interesting. I want to see new places and meet new people and understand different things. And then I think, you know, with that hand in hand. I grew up with a younger brother with severe special needs. And I think from a young age, kind of knowing compassion and caring for others. So I think I had that from a really young age. And I think they just kind of went together of like, well, how can I do both of those things? How can I make that come together? So I think both of those things really are a motivator and a drive and kind of got me where I am now.
I know that you grew up Catholic and you went to Catholic school until middle school time. Mm-hmm. You were in there. Your mother was there for you, and you're again in this small Midwestern town. Where do you think you got your values from?
From my family, yeah. You know, coming from a large family where I saw and experienced people really coming together and supporting one another. And I think, again, seeing all the care that my brother received and just kind of knowing that from such a young age, I think that things are a bit bigger than you and people are in need and how important it is when people really step in and provide help and support. So I think it was around me within my family, but we also had a lot of support within the community, you know, people that provided support for our family and came into our home to provide care for my brother. So I think that really was a big impact on me as well.
And what kind of people is this coming in? Is this the local human services, or is it the Catholic Church? There's a committee of the women who come and take care of you, or is it some other organization?
I think it was just like a local human resources services. My mom was young and had, you know, me and my brother, and I think she really found someone within the community that really linked her to different resources for families with children with special needs, you know, caregivers of various sorts, whether it be nurses or home aides or things like that, teachers' aides, all of that kind of stuff, all different kinds of people that came and really made an impact and helped our family so much.
I'd be relatively surprised if Giselle Bolton wasn't a big reader when she was young. You haven't told me this ahead of time, but I'm guessing. I'm wondering if you ever read the books like, you know, Florence Nightingale or whatever, and said, yeah, I want to be that person in that situation. No stories?
No.
Maybe you played PlayStation your entire childhood. I don't know.
No, I played instruments, but I haven't read that.
But I'm wondering if there's those kinds of stories of people going abroad, reaching out, going into the crisis situations.
Not that I can think of. I mean, for as long as I could remember, my dream job when I was younger was National Geographic. Like, I really wanted to do like photojournalism. And then when I got a little bit older, like high school, and like kind of learned more about what is going on in the world, I think I wanted to do like a war correspondent or something like that. So I don't know. That was kind of where the photojournalism and National Geographic like was, you know, I was really interested in that. And then more, okay, I would really want to understand like what's going on with these people in these situations, that kind of stuff. So I got a piece of that dream job. You know, I get to work with people and know their story and their experience.
So was Giselle, when she was a little girl, middle school, high school, was she an adrenaline junkie?
I don't think so, no.
No.
Do you think I am now?
No, I don't have that sense of
no.
You, but this attraction to places which, wow, I don't think you can be held back from there. So clearly you have a large element of compassion, of responsibility. I'm not sure which you would rate as your top qualities. What do you think?
Oh, gosh, that's really hard. I'm not sure. I don't know.
And one other possibility might be just be that you're a very competent person, just an excellent mind, so you can say, they need someone good to do this, and I'm the one. It could be.
I think I'm becoming more confident that way. I mean, just because I continue to get so many new experiences that do make me equipped to go to these places and do these things. Without one of these experiences there, I wouldn't have made it to the other. I think it's all been a very natural, at least for me, you know, getting these different experiences, different places. Also, the ability to have the mindset and be able to really manage and tolerate and handle it as well. So it all comes together for me that way.
Folks, you're listening to Spirit in Action. Our website, northernspiritradio.org, where we've got 18 and a half years of our interviews, our visits with people doing world healing work, which is certainly what Giselle Bolton is about. I'm going to review a lot of her history, her training that got her ready to do this kind of work. I don't think you just show up in Gaza without a lot of preparation and be able to do any good. So we're going to review all that, but on the northernspiritradio.org website, you'll find all of our programs, our contacts. We're going to be speaking with Giselle about Nonviolent Peace Force, and you can, on my site, I've interviewed both of the founders of Nonviolent Peace Force, people who've traveled and who were working in Palestine, in Israel. It's all on there, and you can find all of the programs and their contacts on our site. When you do listen to a program, please post a comment on your experience of listening to the program. But the most important part for me of doing Northern Spirit Radio is to help enable and motivate people to do world healing work. And it's not just issues we need to talk about. We need support of community to get there. And so please do post a comment, let us know, enter into community with us. And while you're there, you can also make a donation. We are supported by our listeners, not by corporations or governments. There's a lot of good NGOs, non-governmental organizations, doing great work in the world. But we want to be responsive to you, our listeners. So please support us if you're able, and please support the community radios, the 35 or so community radio stations across the United States that carry our programs. Again, Giselle Bolton is here. You'll find on the northernspiritradio.org website connections to organizations like Nonviolent Peace Force, the French INGOs like ACTED, A-C-T-E-D, and other organizations she's been active with. Just come to the site rather than rattling off websites to you. I'm going to ask that you do that, folks. Let's talk, Giselle, about the training, first of all, that you got that moved you towards this career. You, again, went to high school in just Chippewa Valley of Wisconsin, and then you went to the Twin Cities, the University of Minnesota, for your major. Tell me about the global studies and the track of the human rights and justice that was your specialty. What is that? How does that work?
Sure, yeah. So wonderful program through the U of M Twin Cities. So I did a BA and my focus was global studies. Under that program, you pick, I'm not sure what it would be now, but there are a few different specific categories and topics that you go under. And mine was human rights and justice. And then once you've selected that, you also then select a specific region. So mine was the Middle East and North and East Africa. So global studies itself, super, super broad, but there are so many different kind of ways that you narrow it down and get really, really specific into something that you are really interested in and could, you know, would want to work in. So that's what it was for me. So human rights and justice in the Middle East and North and East Africa. So like I mentioned, through that program, also you have to study abroad. It's mandatory, I'm pretty sure. So I studied at the University of Jordan. You have to study a language for 2 years at least. So I studied Arabic. So it's really specific towards the region that you've chosen. And then also, you know, all of your courses fall under these, you know, international politics, human rights, global studies, all these different topics. So yeah, that was kind of the more like theoretical, you know, classroom kind of stuff that I did at the U of M through that program. But then also, like I said, I traveled in the summer on like shorter missions to kind of get a little feel for that, you know, field work. And I did that. There's a Global Studies Student Association. So a group that you're part of, you know, outside of courses, and you choose a place that you're going to go that summer and work with like a local NGO in that location, kind of understand what their needs are. And then you work towards going there that whole school year and then go for the summer. So I went to, like I mentioned, Honduras and then Kenya another summer. So a lot of different pieces of experience and kind of getting you ready for what a real world humanitarian career could look like. And then I took, I think right after I graduated, I went to Lebanon for a year to hang out and applied for grad school. And yeah, then I went to London for my master's. So Yeah, I was in London and I studied international politics and human rights. So just kind of another add-on to what I had already studied. So
with this concern with human rights and justice and all that kind of thing, much of your work in the last 5-6 years has been with camp management for people who are displaced internally or externally from the country. It feels to me like camp management could be a very bureaucratic thing. I mean, you have to know how to work with people, and people are important in that thing. But is that also related to your passion, I think, for human rights?
Yeah, absolutely. So I love getting into the details of what CCCM really is. So to make it really simple, like CCCM, camp management, is coordination of humanitarian services. So anything that anyone who is in any kind of camp or informal setting displaced, they need water, they need shelter, they need protection, they need health, they need education, all of our basic human rights. When you're doing camp management, you are responsible for making sure those people get those services. So you're coordinating all of that. So it's not a little, not a small responsibility. So that's that really, really direct human connection to, I do this and it makes sure these people receive this. An example of that, when I was a camp manager in Northeast Syria. So I was managing a camp of, about 4,000 people. It's my responsibility to make sure all of those critical humanitarian services are in that camp. So there better be food, there better be water, education, protection, health. So that means I need to coordinate with all of the other international or national organizations that do those services. So all those organizations that are out there that are specific to health, well, they need to coordinate and I need to coordinate with them and say, hey, I have this many people here, they need this, this, and this, and making sure that that comes and happens. Same with water, same with food, making sure food and enough food gets there for all the people. So for me, that's the direct connection with making sure those humans are, those human rights are being respected and guaranteed, at least to the bare minimum, through camp management.
I'd actually distinguish between human rights and human needs. It's very clear you can't have your human rights if you don't have your human needs. So I completely understand that that's a foundation on which you can deal with human rights. But free speech or being able to vote or dealing with discrimination, is that something that camp management gets to deal with?
Camp management gets to deal with everything. I mean, when you're a camp manager, you're basically like a little mayor, you're dealing with every single thing that would be going on within a small city or village. So that you have the social cohesion issues that you need to address. So that's also making sure that individuals are forming their own within the community own like government structures and systems of community building and things like that, and community representation, and this kind of stuff is all part of what camp managers are responsible for doing. Also ensuring that individuals with, people with specific needs, women, all these kinds of things, making sure that they're involved in the decision making that's going on inside the camp. So it's a really huge component, actually, is making sure that community engagement is there and that they're being part of the decision making and they're driving, telling us, okay, here's what we actually need, here's what we want, this is what's going on. And then it's just your role to, okay, feed that up and say, okay, here's who we can reach out to, this is what the needs are, they're telling us that. So there's a lot of different pieces to it.
I am also thinking that your initial work, right after you finished your master's, you were active with the Nonviolent Peace Force. And again, I've interviewed several people who've done service within Peace Force, as well as the founders of the organization. Talk about your work when you went to South Sudan with the NP.
Sure, yeah. So this was back in 2016, I believe, and I was really fortunate, and, speaking of getting hands-on experience during, your education and training, I interned with NP in Minneapolis office. So I got a taste for what NP does and kind of what their missions looked like and what their mission was. So I was really fortunate that way, and I kind of knew right from then, I think that might be somewhere I want to work for. Eventually, after I did my master's, I went on a mission as a protection officer in South Sudan. So I was working with displaced communities in a really remote location, providing trainings on unarmed civilian peacekeeping and gender-based violence and other peace-building topics for social cohesion. At that time, we were trying to like share information and trainings on community building and bringing communities together, how we could improve and like share those tools for things like that. So that was my experience with MP.
And how long were you involved with them there in South Sudan?
Just 6 months.
6 months. Mm-hmm. Just. Yeah. How many people here would consider it major drain on their system to be there for a week, 2 weeks, but 6 months is a lot. The image I have of Nonviolent Peace Force and the work you're doing, the things you just listed off, Giselle, sounded to me like the training that you had for human rights, that kind of thing. You didn't list off there that you were busy feeding people or making sure they had water or whatever. And that's the thing I was wondering about contrast. Is there usually a mix overlap? I mean, I'm still imagining in South Sudan, you tried to help people get water all the same because you needed it for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's more where that camp management role comes in. So here's an example of, like, I know in South Sudan, I wasn't working in the camps there, but I know the context. So NP, where they were working in camps, the camp management was the one that asked, hey, can you guys come in and do some protection activities here? So that's actually how those activities are provided, because NP is a protection, you know, civilian protection agency, and provide services such as that as the accompaniment, things like that, different contexts, different services. But it would definitely be someone who's working in CCCM to kind of coordinate actually with NP and say, hey, can you guys come and potentially do some protection stuff? So it depends where you're working for, where you would be either, you know, handing out bottles of water, which is not what I do, but, you know, making sure that someone would be coming in and doing water trucking, things like that, is all under that CCCM component, if that makes sense of the difference. Like, one organization provides something very specific, but CCCM people are making sure all those different specific people are linking together.
And did you, in your period in South Sudan, actually have to deal with violence happening around you, the threat from the north? That's right after South Sudan became a separate country.
Yeah. So specifically where I was, I did not. That being said, I was the only site that didn't have to evacuate because of security situation. So I don't know how, but yeah, I was the only one. I think it was me and like two other colleagues, and the site that we were at, it happened that it was a more calm area. But yeah, everyone else, I remember when I was there, yeah, they were all evacuated to Kenya for a couple of weeks. So it was certainly, you know, unstable at the time, for sure.
Was Nonviolent Peace Force distributed to many other areas in South Sudan?
Yeah, all over South Sudan. I just happened to be in an area that was within community. So I was working with like displaced individuals in different villages, different areas, but some people were working directly in Juba inside camps. So it really just varied where the needs really were throughout the country. So yeah, MP was working everywhere. Each site was really different. Some of them you had to walk through a river and a lake and take a boat and live in a tent. And, you know, the needs of the community were completely different than what they were in Juba in a camp, and what the needs were where I was in a village. So really, really different.
Well, the year after you did Nonviolent Peace Force work, you went to Nepal. And could you talk about the fellowship that you did there and what skills you gained at that point? Again, we're moving forward to the point where Giselle Bolton is in demand for going to try and help with human needs in Gaza.
I was in Nepal in, I think it was 2015, when the massive earthquake happened. I think it was April of 2015, but huge earthquake, devastating. And I just happened to be there working with a small women's organization that provided leadership trainings and things like that for young women. And then my experience shifted a bit into kind of emergency disaster response, because then we linked with, there was a larger U.S.-based organization that linked with us saying, you know, is there any need? Would it be interesting to come and provide some disaster response and emergency trainings for the young women in the programs that you're in? And we're like, yeah, that would be awesome. You know, they're super interested. They want to get involved and help their community. So this organization came and provided those trainings. So yeah, it was happened that I was there and then just kind of got an experience by being there in emergency response.
So you weren't there for a terribly long time, mm-hmm. but not too long after that, a year or two later, you started traveling pretty widely. Iraq, I think, was the next country that you went to?
Yes. Yep.
What were you doing in Iraq and with which organization?
Sure. So I was working in Iraq with ACTED. This was in 2018, I believe. So at that time, I was managing community resource centers. So these resource centers were meant for individuals who were either coming back to their area of origin because they had left because of ISIS, and now we're coming back to kind of reintegrate, or it's for individuals who can no longer live in the area that they're from, and so they're moving to a new area and need to resettle. These resource centers provided all the information for different services available in that area. People might be looking for housing, education, employment, this kind of stuff. So this is at a time of a little bit more recovery stabilization, I would say, after some liberation in the area. And also at that time, some camps were closing. So when you have camp closures, you have people looking to either resettle or integrate into a new community. Those centers really provided that critical source and information of here's what's available, here's what's going on in this community.
It was half tongue-in-cheek when I was asking you, Giselle, about whether you were an adrenaline junkie. I'm partly thinking that one of your primary abilities, talents, is compassion. I'm thinking that mixed in with that, there must be a very large dose of courage, of bravery, of willingness to face scary situations. Does that sound like you? I just met you today, right?
It does, yeah. I think that sums it up pretty well, actually, yeah.
Where does that come from? Was it because you were on the boxing team? Because
not at all. My gosh, I was in marching band. I don't know where that comes from, to be honest with you. But yeah, I think, yeah, there's definitely some courage there. And
what movies did you like to watch growing up?
I liked, like, Disney movies. I don't know. Nothing crazy. I don't know.
For a while, you were in Iraq, and then you were in Syria, and then you were in Turkey, actually, all of these kinds of things. These are areas which are heavily Muslim. I don't think that the Catholic Church, where you got raised, trains you a lot to deal with different religions like that. Islamic religion certainly is very significantly different. And the people have different base assumptions about how life should be. Did you have to deal with that, or is this a enclosure? Sometimes, when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Togo, West Africa, I was living in the community, but there were international USAID people who were living in different, almost different communities, and they would just kind of do sorties out of their isolated international community into the common folks. So when you're traveling, I'm thinking you're living pretty much with the people.
Yeah, it definitely depends on where I am at the time and if the context allows for us to be directly within the community and like how much freedom of movement and all that fun stuff, because, you know, definitely we're not just wandering around in Iraq wherever we want or Syria. But, you know, again, I will come back to, I definitely grew up that you accept people and where they're from and different religions and all that kind of stuff. I mean, no question. It was very clear. I don't know. So for me, I'm like, well, of course, you know, I can go live in a Muslim country, or I don't know. Maybe I didn't know about different religions very much growing up in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, but I think there was a level of acceptance that I was always taught. And again, my education and experiences during my undergrad, for example, studying at the University of Jordan, you know, I was in a Muslim country, so becoming culturally aware and accepting and doing my best to kind of integrate into a community like that. So I have been living in Muslim countries for like the last 6 years. Long time.
What would you describe as the strengths or weaknesses of being in the countries where you've been? I'm specifically thinking that part of my experience living abroad and traveling a fair amount in Africa, it feels to me like people take care of each other much better in Africa than I saw in Europe. And not that they were unfriendly or anything in Europe, not at all. But it's like people would quite literally give you the shirt off of their back in Africa.
Yes, Absolutely. I think that sense of community and taking care of one another, I've just had nothing but that in the places that I've worked and lived, to be completely honest. I've always been so welcomed and so well taken care of. I mean, the amount of times that I'm invited to dinner, invited over to family's homes, I mean, always people dropping things off at my apartment or making sure they invite me to just like spend time with their families or go out with them because they know I'm living in a place away from family and friends, like so well taken care of. So that sense of community and taking care of one another, seeing that and living that and experiencing it, I just feel so grateful because it's really different. It's something really different than what we have here. Not that people aren't friendly or, you know, like you said, are not taking care of each other, but I think it's just this sense of community and caring for one another is completely different. And yeah, I'm so grateful I've had that.
Do you end up feeling at all lonely coming back to Chippewa Falls?
Yes.
and talk about that because a lot of people won't understand that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a huge, huge part of what makes coming home kind of so emotional and a little bit, to be completely honest with you, why probably I jumped to the next mission quite quick. You know, I've always been, I'm going to come home and take a long break and do what? You know, I mean, it feels really strange because it's just so separate here. So yeah, it's definitely difficult. And I think, you know, it's kind of also the longer that I'm gone and the more frequently, you know, it's been the better part of the last 6 years, almost solid. You know, maybe I've come back for a month here and there for the last few years, but that's it. So it's really tough because you come home and you kind of have in your head maybe what you were so used to 6 or 7 years ago, and life has changed, and your sense of your circle and your friendships and things like that, it's all completely changed. And I will say that it's a lot easier for me to come home and be in other people's worlds, and we can connect that way as much as I possibly can. But it's really tough to try to bring people here into my world. So that being said, I want to say I'm really happy that I've met you and thank you so much for having me here because it's really nice to get to share this because it doesn't happen so often and it's not so easy to do because it's tough stuff to explain.
I remember my own experience of, I connect with people easily, but I still remember coming back and my hunger for the kind of connection, immediacy, presence with each other. I think that having a lot of money and possessions creates an insulation, a blanket that keeps us disengaged from other people. Mm-hmm. And my experience of living in Africa for 2 years, as I did when I was in the Peace Corps, and the other places I visited, my sense is that there's an immediacy and connection that here is barely possible.
Yeah, definitely. I would agree with that completely. And I think the level of just being present with one another and really engaging and taking the time. I think also time, you know, we kind of discussed this, you know, time just kind of moves different and has this different kind of heaviness and meaning. If you're not on time here, it's a really big deal, right? I mean, even for me, I'm super on time for, you know, especially when I come home, you better be 10 minutes early. But if you're, you know, a few minutes late or 15 minutes late, you know, in different parts of the world, I mean, it's such a more laid back mentality, I think. And time doesn't have this huge rush and we're not rushing everywhere to get one place to the other. I think you can slow down a little bit, if that makes sense. And I think that's really different. It makes a big difference.
Yeah, the difference in schedules, really noticeable.
Yeah.
And mind you, when I was in the Peace Corps, I was teaching at a lycée in a small village. So things were on schedule there. This is when class stops, this is when it starts. All of that is very clear. But still, people would be present and meander and look you. And relationship, I think, came first. And
yes.
In the U.S., the
yes.
schedule comes first.
Absolutely. Completely. Because it actually took me a little bit once I started working in this sector and kind of working in different contexts and different environments. And you're working with people from different places, different backgrounds, to make sure that you sit down and have tea with your logs officer before you just rush in and be like, I need this, this, and this. I mean, these human connections and being present with one another and those relationships are critical and significantly more important than just rushing into somebody, I need this done right now. I mean, sit down and have a cup of tea and ask how my family is doing. You know, did I have breakfast or not? You know? So yeah, I think those relationships are the priority.
I was wondering, in the Muslim countries in particular, there have been various... At one point, Iran was a very progressive Islamic country. Actually, maybe it was a secular country more at that point. Women did not have to be covered and so on. Do you have to deal with that in these countries? I mean, Iraq and Sudan and everything. You've got beautiful long hair, and in a lot of places in the Muslim world, you got to keep that covered.
Mm-hmm. It really depends on where I'm working, what I'm doing. Like, for example, if I'm going to a camp that I know is really very conservative and it's just going to be purely out of respect, I will cover my hair temporarily or just put it up, you know, just to be a little. I also want to not be a big look at me being here, you know, so also just to blend in a little bit more. And I think just naturally dressing more conservative and things like that, again, just to be respectful. It's not anything that I've ever like felt forced by any means to do, or, you know, I have to cover my hair, have to wear a certain thing. But definitely, I think out of respect for other people and their culture and yeah, the community.
There are some places, some of them in the United States, where women having authority over man is not accepted. Has that been at all an issue in the places where you've worked?
Yeah, I think especially, you know, I'm just trying to think, I think most conservative and where that would be in Bangladesh, you don't really see women out so much. I mean, you can definitely feel a different dynamic within the community of kind of who's around, who's working, who's at the office, these kinds of things. So more male-dominated, maybe communities or societies, things like that have definitely been in for sure.
So Giselle, there are so many other things I could talk to you about, but mainly what I want to do is just spend the time. I would like to feed you meals. We can go out and work on the maple syrup that's cooking in the backyard.
I love that.
It's good to be grounded, and it's also good to be grounded in community. When you're working abroad, including in Gaza, is there a community there with you? And I'm talking maybe about the people that you've worked alongside in places like Iraq, Syria, Bangladesh, Gaza. Is there a community that continues with you?
Yes. It's really crazy how small my world is. It's really crazy. Anywhere I'm going at any time, I can be like, oh, hey, I think I saw that person was here right now on a mission. Like, I was going through Egypt and met up with a friend that I worked with in Iraq 5 years ago. I was in Jordan. I hung out with a girl that I studied abroad with forever ago during our undergrad. We studied together in Jordan. I definitely have, even if we're not together all the time, we don't get to see each other often. The sense of community that I have and the connections that I have with, you know, a handful of people, very deep connections and so important. So I hang on dearly to those because having those connections makes it possible to keep doing this. That's what keeps me going, and people that understand, and you can kind of shoot a message at any point and I don't know where in this world they might be at this point, but the connection is still there. The understanding is still there. You don't have to explain yourself. You know, I mean, these are really important pieces, and, you know, I hope that I'm that for other people as well, because you're able to keep going that way. So yeah, I'm so grateful for the people that I've met along the way and that we keep going together, even if they're in Ukraine and I'm in Gaza or Bangladesh and somebody's in Haiti. We're still so connected, which is pretty incredible.
Well, Giselle, I'm not finding the right words that I want to give you to express my appreciation for your work, for your care, in some of the most difficult places in the world. I mean, I know that sometimes in the United States, if a car doesn't start, we feel like that's a big challenge to the day. But our house wasn't just blown up, and we're not starving and facing a child that's going to die because there's no such thing as medication. All those things which are just day-to-day for this work you've been doing last 5 or 6 years, I don't know that I could ever appreciate enough the work that you do and these other people of your communities who are really doing this healing work for the world. But I'm so grateful that you came here to spend the day with me today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This has just been wonderful to connect. So thank you very much. And thanks for letting me share some of my stories. I appreciate it.
We're going to have some links on our site. Nonviolent Peace Force, certainly part of it. And the various NGOs, INGOs, the international non-governmental organizations like ACTED and the others that Giselle Bolton has been active with. We'll have those links on the site. Maybe you want to do studies. Maybe you want to volunteer your efforts to support them. All of that, we'll have it on northernspiritradio.org. Again, thanks so much, Giselle, for joining us.
Thank you.
And folks, we'll see you next week for Spirit in Action. The theme music for this program is Turning of the World, performed by Sarah Thompson. Check out all things Spirit in Action on northernspiritradio.org. Guests, links, stations, and a place for your feedback, suggestions, and support. Thanks for listening. I'm Mark Helpsmeet, and I hope you find deep roots to support you to grow steadily toward the light. This is Spirit in Action.